This is an interview with Bill McLucas for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum and Archive on the History of Financial Regulation. I'm James Stoker. Today is March 5th, 2012. Welcome, Mr. McLucas.
Good morning.
So I understand you're from Western Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I grew up in a very small town between Elton and Johnstown in the coal mountains in Western Pennsylvania.
Okay. Did you always plan on becoming a securities lawyer?
I never planned on becoming a securities lawyer. I fell into it, basically. I worked at a banking agency for less than 2 years after law school. The old Federal Home Loan Bank Board, which regulated the S&L industry, was on a case that had been referred to the SEC, met the enforcement staff over there, and that was the vehicle by which I ended up getting hired in the enforcement division.
Okay. Did you study business or anything like that as an undergraduate?
No. I was a liberal arts major. I never had a securities law course,
okay,
which a lot of people observed over the years was quite in evidence, but basically learned it as I went. I mean, I had corporations and I had all the basic courses in law school, but I wasn't a securities law student or aficionado or anything like that.
Okay. Why did you decide to go into government service instead of private practice?
Basically because it opened more doors than it closed. I was really not prepared to go to a law firm and commit to any one particular area of practice. And it seemed to me that the opportunity and the doors that were opened for a young lawyer coming out of law school then were just far broader if you went into public service than if you joined a law firm.
Mm-hmm. So when you joined the SEC, did you expect to stay as long as you eventually did?
No. I mean, I expected I would be there 4 or 5 years, learn quite a bit, and then actually move on and get a job in a law firm and, mm-hmm, and practice law.
What did you think of the SEC before you joined it? I mean, what was kind of the image in your mind, if you think back?
Well, this was 1977. It was the tail end of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, or what I would call the Foreign Payments Program, mm-hmm, just shortly after the passage of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. And the agency, and certainly its enforcement program, was really on a high note. It was viewed as the best agency in federal government. Stanley Sporkin had a reputation that was well known throughout the country. The division was populated by very young, very aggressive lawyers, and the cases they brought and the things that the agency was doing at that point in time were extraordinary, largely emerging out of the questionable payments program, the facts that developed after the committee to reelect the president was revealed to have funneled hundreds of thousands of dollars in black bags from public companies to support the campaign to reelect the president. And it was just a very fascinating agency, and for a young lawyer that wanted to be involved in more aggressive prosecutorial types of things, it was a very attractive place to go.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that Stanley Sporkin was the director of enforcement at that time. Was he the one who hired you?
I got hired by a group of people. I didn't meet Stanley for months after I joined the agency. I got hired in the ordinary course after interviewing with a series of people. The guy who actually hired me was a young lawyer by the name of Richard Brodsky, who is now in private practice in Florida.
How big was the enforcement department at this time?
My recollection is that the entire division was probably in the 220, maybe 230 or 40. That would be an approximation. It certainly wasn't much larger than that. And comparatively speaking, it was quite small.
Mm-hmm. Was there any sort of training program when you first got there, or did you just start working on cases right away?
There were training programs. You went to seminars. You got the materials you were expected to read. You were trained somewhat in how to take testimony. It was not nearly as sophisticated as it became. I mean, my first real witness, my branch chief, sat in the room with me for approximately 45 minutes. We took a break, and he said, "You look like you know what you're doing. Don't screw it up." And that was it, you know.
What sorts of issues were you working on when you first got there, or what sorts of cases?
Early on, I did a number of accounting cases, and I did some cases in the area of insurance. Remember, insurance is not regulated at the federal level, and there was, at the time, a widespread perception that there was a fair amount of abuse in the insurance industry. So the SEC got into the business of looking at a lot of insurance companies by way of the holding companies that were public, and I did a number of those kinds of cases.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any contact with the commissioners during these early days?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the process was conceptually similar to what it is today, but the environment was very different. I went to commission meetings just to sit through the meetings and see what would happen, but I met with commissioners. When my case was going to the calendar, I would get summoned to a commissioner's office with the commissioner and the legal assistants, and I would walk through, answer the questions. And back then, the people I worked for insisted that the staff lawyer go and answer the question. And they may go with you, but it was a far more open experience, in that my exposure to and contact with commissioners early on was significant compared to what I think occurs today.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you had quite a bit of responsibility at that time compared to what a young lawyer in private practice might have had.
Well, that's true, and it's a product of two things. It's a function of being in public service, because you are pushed and pushed to do things sooner rather than later and take responsibility. And frankly, the more you will do and the more assertive you will be about trying to learn more and take more responsibility, the more you're likely to get, because there's more work to do than people to do it. And secondly, I think the agency, by dint of the workload and the personality types there, was inclined to allow you to take on more responsibility and do more if you were willing to do it and had the appetite to be aggressive about it.
Can you walk me through the process of rising up the ranks in the enforcement department at this time? Was the next step from being a junior lawyer becoming an assistant director?
No. At that time, you were a staff lawyer, and if you were to get promoted, you would become a branch chief. And a branch chief then would have perhaps six or seven lawyers that reported directly to him or her. Then usually two branch chiefs would report to an assistant director, and then there were only two associate directors at the time, and there would be three assistant directors report to each associate director, and that was the hierarchy of supervision in the division.
Did you ever serve outside of the D.C. Area?
No. Well, I did. I did temporarily. In 1987, there were some issues in the New York regional office, and the regional administrator resigned, and then the head of enforcement resigned, or the head of enforcement actually resigned first, and then the regional administrator resigned. David Reuter was the chairman at the time. I was an associate director. I think I'd been an associate director for maybe a year, maybe a little longer, a year and a half. And David called me and said, "I'd like you to go to New York for a few weeks and help run the office." And I was not particularly anxious to go to New York. And I said, "Can I think about it overnight?" He said, "Sure." I said, "Well, how long do you think it'll be?" He said, "6 weeks." I said, "That means 4 months." He said, "That's right." So, but I agreed to do it. And what I would spend 3 to 4 days a week in New York, and then 2 days in Washington, and I kept my regular group and my branch here, and I went to New York for that period of time with Jim Clarkson to try to stabilize that office until they selected a new regional administrator.
Okay. We're going to go back in time just a little bit. Tell me a little bit about working with Stanley Sporkin. What was he like?
He was wonderful. I mean, Stanley has and always had a particular style of doing business. He is extraordinarily perceptive and smart in ways that I think sometimes people don't quite appreciate, because he's also somewhat idiosyncratic. But Stanley could absorb an enormous amount of information in a very, very abbreviated time period. He read quite a bit. And his combination of aggressiveness with compassion was what was quite extraordinary about him. If you talk to people on the outside of the agency at the time, everyone thought the agency was too aggressive, Stanley was too aggressive, there was just a cadre of young, really tough lawyers there, and it was difficult to deal with people. The truth was, for very successful defense lawyers and people who understood the process, if you could get into Stanley's office and get a meeting, Stanley was an extraordinarily good listener, and he could size up a case, but size up people. And if you, as a staff lawyer, were really committed to a certain result in a tough enforcement action, the thing you hated to do was to get the defense counsel, or worse, their clients, in a meeting with Stanley, because Stanley had a very soft heart, and he would always figure out a way to get to a settlement or a deal that would concede something. And it was actually one of the things that made him a really effective director. He was probably one of a handful of people that I would say was among the best leaders that I've ever worked for or been involved with. If you define leadership as the capacity to get people to follow you in the face of almost anything, he was capable of doing that in a way that very few people I've ever worked with or for was ever able to do.
Do you think that defense lawyers that were arguing cases with the commission, do you think that they were aware of the fact that they, it might be in their interest to sort of get in the office with him?
It worked when you were good, when you knew the facts, and when you had a genuine case. It did not work for people who were slick or who played games with the process. I mean, I saw him in meetings undress lawyers in ways that, you know, were quite remarkable. He was not a pushover. He could read the room well, and if he had to err in a tough case, it would be on the side of being more compassionate rather than less, more reasonable rather than less. And yet, if somebody pushed the wrong buttons or played games in the process, he was pretty tough. He would be pretty dismissive.
How did his leadership style compare with someone like John Fetters or Gary Lynch?
Well, very, very different people, John Fetters and Gary Lynch. John came in from private practice, was an extraordinarily smart and able lawyer. Early on, reflected a slight level of disdain for the tenured staff, and that took a while for him to, I think, conquer or overcome. But he was very able. He had a very he had an extraordinary work ethic, and he had a leadership style that was just very different from Stanley's. Gary was somebody who had come up through the ranks, had been the key supervisor on the Dennis Levine, Ivan Boesky, Marty Siegel insider trading investigations, which, if you recall, by 1986 or so, had really become the core of the agency's most visibly and aggressively identified enforcement agenda. And Gary was only 34 years old at the time, or 35 years old when he became the director. He had a reservoir of support within the division simply because he grew up in the division. He was there, he understood the process, He understood how to get things done, and you know, he was somebody that could get whatever he needed out of the staff, and he was somebody who was very quiet in terms of his leadership style, but very, very effective.
You just brought up the issue of insider trading. Was this a priority when you joined the SEC?
There were cases, but it wasn't a priority. And the backstory on insider trading at that point in time is quite interesting. John Shadd became the chairman during President Reagan's first administration. And John had been an investment banker. He was very much a product of Wall Street. He understood the securities markets. And he also had a what I would characterize as a deep level of skepticism of the enforcement mechanism and the enforcement program. When early in his tenure, there were philosophical debates within the agency about whether we should be suing public companies at all. And he had commissioned research by the General Counsel's office on the notion that perhaps we should only name individuals and not companies because the cost associated with those cases came out of the pockets of shareholders. And he also, if you were to go back and examine the first few years of John Shadd's tenure, you will find very few cases brought against the securities industry, the big firms, based on failure to supervise, because John's theory was, if one person in a big firm does something bad, you name that person, you don't name the firm. And these were huge philosophical debates. Part of the reason we ended up in the insider trading business, to the extent we were, was that we were shifting resources out of investigating accounting and financial fraud and disclosure and into investigating insider trading, which the common wisdom was only a behavior engaged in by rogue individuals at isolated firms or public companies or people who were bad people.
Was everyone supportive of that decision?
No. No. I mean, there was enormous unhappiness, and to some extent there were morale issues in the Division of Enforcement. And this is an agency that historically responds extremely well to political change, and I say that with a small p. That's why we have elections. There are philosophical perspectives on the role of government, and the division pretty dutifully soldiered on. These were decisions made by presidential appointees about how to, and where to deploy commission resources, and we did what we were supposed to do. When the Dennis Levine case broke, and that led to Boesky and to Marty Siegel, and then Boesky led to Drexel Burnham and to Michael Milken, it took a while for the chairman to process what this meant, because we now had taken a can opener to the industry, the investment banking community that he'd come from, and it was very difficult for him to come to terms with this and accept it. And there were, you know, there was more than one long conversation that Gary had with the chairman explaining, John, this really happened. We didn't make this evidence up. This is what happened. And it was a turning point, in a sense, for the commission and for the chairman in terms of his philosophical approach to law enforcement, because it was, I think, a sad turn of events for him. But we, in my view, backed into those cases, into that scandal, because we were backing out of doing some of the more conventional law enforcement things that, frankly, had upset a number of people prior to the Republican administration coming in 1980.
So even prior to these big cases that you mentioned, the Boesky, Drexel, and Milken cases, the commission had already begun to work with Congress on a variety of new laws that governed insider trading
Sanctions, right? Act of 1984, which followed, I think, the Paul Thayer case. I don't know the date of that case, but there was a series of cases. If you remember, too, we went through an enormous uptick in merger and acquisition activity in the late 70s, early 80s. Mm-hmm. That was, in a sense, the environmental backdrop for all this insider trading. Enormous opportunity for profit and for people to take advantage of information.
Mm-hmm. Did the SEC work closely with the Congress on the Insider Trading Sanctions Act of 1984?
I believe we did. I was not, you know, that involved in any of the legislative efforts at the time. In 1984, I would have been, I believe, an assistant director. But yeah, there would have been a lot of coordination between the staff on the commission, particularly in the legislative affairs and the general counsel's office and the Hill staff.
How important was that law to these prosecutions that happened during the mid-1980s?
Well, critical, because you ended up having more than just an injunction, which essentially is a court order that says go and sin no more and pay back the profits. You now had the prospect of real economic deterrence being attached if you got caught.
Right. Okay. And then in 1988, there was another law passed, the Insider Trading and Securities Fraud Enforcement Act,
right.
which expanded the penalties available to the SEC. Did the SEC also work closely with the Congress on this,
absolutely,
this law?
Absolutely, and that would have been under David Reuter. And the most significant piece of that legislation, which again emerged out of the cases involving securities professionals and market professionals, were the requirements that registered entities, investment advisors and broker-dealers, have written policies and procedures to prevent and detect insider trading, and then the potential for vicarious liability as a controlling person if one of their employees actually traded or was engaged in insider trading.
Were the relationships between the SEC and the Congress primarily at the level of the commissioners, or did the staff also have contact with the Congress as well?
The staff had a lot of contact at the division director level with the senior staff on the oversight committees as a routine matter. There were always tensions, no matter what administration was in the executive branch and what party controlled the legislative branch and the oversight committees. When John Shadd was the chairman, John Dingell was the chairman of what was then the House Energy and Commerce Committee, and John Shadd testified so many times, I don't think he could even count them, but there's nothing he hated more than having to go to the Hill and testify in front of John Dingell.
Mm-hmm.
They actually got along in a certain way, but philosophically they saw the world differently, and it was always an unpleasant experience for the chairman to go over there and testify. That process, which has changed a little bit in the degree to which it's, I think under Mary Shapiro, it is a lot more civil and professional, but over the years that process has always been one where there's been a certain amount of tension for the agency chairman and the commissioners who get summoned to testify in front of those committees.
But at this time, during these big cases in the mid-1980s, did you feel like Congress was pushing you all to be more aggressive, or were they pushing you to back off a little bit?
My sense is they were pushing us to be more aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a process whereby the agency was having to come to terms with the fact that, you know, the enforcement program had uncovered these abuses. We now had to deal with them, and maybe legislation was going to be needed.
Okay. So, right before you became director of enforcement, or actually possibly right afterwards, Congress passed the law in 1990, the Securities
Remedies
Enforcement
Act.
Remedies Act.
Right.
Right. So clearly, you had also worked closely with the Congress on the
right.
language of this bill.
Right.
Was it generally the case that the SEC would just draft the type of legislation that they'd like to see and send it on over to the committee, or was it not so direct?
It would be far more a process of discussion, collaboration, and the Remedies Act was the product of Richard Breeden's experience when he worked for Vice President Bush at the time in the first Reagan administration on the, I think it was the Financial Institutions Task Force, but Richard had a view of particularly the banking and thrift industry that was not very flattering, and he'd seen the worst of what had emerged in the S&L crisis of the 80s. And he'd also seen from afar, which is frequently a very valuable vantage point from which to assess an agency, that the SEC lacked any remedial power other than injunctive relief. You had penalties available in insider trading cases, and that was it. In other civil cases, when you dealt with violations of the federal securities laws, you were without a remedy. And the remedy was, the deterrent was that most companies worried about shareholder litigation and class action lawsuits. Breeden came into office and I think spent a fair amount of time discussing with people on the oversight committees the reality that if we were going to have an effective program and deal with law violators in a constructive way, we really needed to have penalty authority at the SEC, and he was the architect, in a sense, behind the thinking about moving the remedies statute before the Congress and getting it passed.
Did you work with Richard Breeden while he was in the vice president's staff?
Didn't know him until the day he walked into the SEC.
Okay. So one more thing about this period of the 1980s. You probably found yourself reading about the division in the newspaper quite a bit. Did you find that the press generally got it right, or did they romanticize these issues of insider trading?
A little bit of both.
Yeah.
In some of the cases, there was a fascination with, when you look, for instance, at the Paul Thayer case, there you had at the time, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, who had gotten caught up prior to his tenure in the, and he was a war hero, in an insider trading mess, and it was a case that was bitterly fought until a certain point when the evidence was overwhelming. But the press, in a sense, loves this idea of, as they still do today, going out and getting the bad guys. And so there was a certain romanticized perspective on the cases, and it was great to read about when you were there. Sometimes you read some of the stories and you thought, gee, I wish it was as glamorous and exciting as it sounds. But it was a period of time when I think Gary was likened to Elliot Ness. And I did some traveling globally then to foreign countries to deal with securities regulators. And it was fascinating to see the way we were perceived around the world. I mean, people thought we must have carried guns and just busted down doors and arrested people. And it was a product, I think, of the general image that the press had created about the program. And it was humorous in some respects.
Do you think that all this attention had any impact on the way the SEC worked? Did it go to anyone's head in the division?
There were some people who got carried away. I mean, there are inevitably, when you have that kind of romanticized view of the work of the agency, and you have the aura created of the good guys and the bad guys, you run the risk that some people pay less attention to the rules and more attention to if we're right. Touching all the bases is important, but it's not really critical. And that was a worry, mm-hmm. You know.
Do you think that this attention and all this public sentiment and the release of films like Wall Street, do you think that had an impact on Congress's interest in the subject?
It did. And it also had an impact on the agency. The agency, in terms of recruiting and in terms of its stature in the public eye, was never higher. I mean, it was an agency that was viewed, even with, you know, the issues that it faced then and some of the problems that it faced in overall approach to regulation, it was fundamentally viewed as a law enforcement agency. Of all the other things the agency does, many of which are critical to capital markets, to capital formation, to investor protection, the widespread perception was these guys basically are, it's a cops and robbers agency. Yeah.
You mentioned that you traveled abroad and worked with foreign governments. How was the globalization of finance at this time affecting the work of the Enforcement Division?
The earliest sort of window I had on that was really in insider trading as a result of the use of, if you recall in the Dennis Levine case, there was a bank in the Bahamas that Dennis Levine, I think at Bank Lou, Dennis Levine had used. What became apparent was that with respect to a small group of very sophisticated people, Switzerland was an extraordinarily convenient vehicle to set up a bank account, conduct trading through a brokerage firm that may have an office in London or in Paris or in Switzerland, and shield everything about your trading through those bank accounts. Michael Mann, who was the first director of what became the Office of International Affairs under John Fetters, began the effort on behalf of the SEC and to some great extent the United States. He worked with the Department of Justice and with the Office of Legal Counsel at the Department of State in negotiating the first agreements with foreign governments, which we called Memoranda of Understanding. They weren't treaties, they were regulator to regulator, and they were agreements pursuant to which we established a protocol to get information. And those were instrumental in opening the doors to relationships with a lot of governments. And because the SEC was in the midst of this cops and robbers, romanticized image in the press, there were many doors that were now open that had previously been closed. There was an appetite by foreign governments and foreign regulators within limits to strike up agreements and arrangements with the SEC because the law enforcement people on the other side of the ocean now saw this as something that made sense. Now, it wasn't a universally accepted view. There was a lot of resistance in Switzerland. That door opened only when in a pending case in the Southern District of New York, one of the judges imposed what at the time was a huge fine of $50,000 a day on the bank until they turned the information over. Mm-hmm. So, but it had an enormous effect on the agencies, the opening of doors by the agency to foreign regulators and the use of IOSCO to become basically a forum for starting to establish a framework for globalization of markets.
Within the Division of Enforcement, were there cases where you sometimes felt that if you had had a memorandum of understanding with a government, you might have been able to pursue them, but because there wasn't a memorandum, you weren't?
Well, you never knew what you missed. Mm-hmm. And that you always had this sense that there might be a lot more out there, but you just can't crack the nut and get the information.
Okay. You know? Yeah. So Richard Breeden took over the chairmanship of the SEC at the end of the 1980s, and he was the one who eventually chose you to be the director. Did this happen right away?
No, I don't know the date. I think Richard was sworn in September of 1989, and he quite patiently in his view and in a maddening sort of, level of uncertainty for a number of us, did nothing with respect to the director's job until the end of December. And we had three associate directors at the time, and each of us would be responsible for the commission calendar for a week or 2 weeks at a time. And Richard just waited and waited and waited, and then on December the 22nd or 23rd, I was getting ready to leave for the Christmas holidays. He summoned me to his office at 4 or 5 o'clock on a Friday night. I had no idea what for. And I don't know if you know Richard, but he's a brilliant guy who does not suffer fools. But I was summoned to his office and brought into the conference room. He came in, sat down, and said, "Look, I made the decision to make you the director. Been a tough process, a lot of able people. Your colleagues down there are quite able, but, you know, I think you would make the best director. And so he, I think, asked me to return to the SEC 2 days after Christmas, had a press conference, and announced that I was going to be the next director of enforcement. So.
Yeah. Did you have a set of priorities that you wanted to accomplish?
Well, the chairman had already focused on the S&L industry, and that was quite clear we were going to do that, number one. Number two, he had a very clear sense of the requirement that we have a presence in accounting and financial disclosure. He had a sense of how we ought to interface with the mutual fund and advisory business. And he and I would sit and talk, but Richard, you know, is a guy who has had and still has very definite views of the world. And his view was, I'm going to set the priorities and you and I are going to work on them, but you know, the door is open, and if you disagree or you have a view or you have a thought, I expect you to be in here and we'll hash it out. And that was basically the relationship, you know.
One of the first big things that happened under your directorship was that the commission settled its case against Michael Milton.
Right.
I think he agreed to pay about $600 million in disgorgement and penalties.
Right, right.
How was that number arrived at?
As I sit here, I couldn't tell you. It was not scientific. It was a product of discussions largely with the chairman's office and the key senior staff on the case, which at the time included Barry Goldsmith, Tom Newkirk, Jim Kaufman, and Tony Cheon. And I think we went back and forth with the chairman, and the chairman basically gave his input and said, this is where we are, this is what I'd like to see. And he was also very direct. He was not a negotiator on a lot of these things. He said, look, here's the number. That's not a number to negotiate from. That's not a number to, this is not a bid. That's it.
A few years earlier, some people had criticized the Boesky settlement as being too little. Do you think that influenced the amount of the settlement?
Don't know that affected the way Richard looked at it. And that criticism didn't really bother me very much, and I don't think it frankly bothered a lot. Other than people thinking, we just broke the biggest insider trading case in history, we just took the veil off a whole series of relationships that will give us the ability to clean up a lot of misconduct in the industry, and now people are carping about the money. That's the very typical, when you're in the middle of the battle looking out, saying, give me a break, folks, you're criticizing us while we're down here duking it out, trying to do God's work. But I don't think that criticism particularly affected the thinking on the penalty. A lot of what colored Richard's view on the financial settlement, I think, was affected by the S&L crisis and where he saw much of the fallout from a broader level of what he characterized as market abuse and misconduct.
So the SEC, as it always had, continued to bring a mixture of both big cases and small cases in terms of insider trading each year. Mm-hmm. How did you decide which cases you were going to prosecute or pursue, I should say?
Well, I mean, we had an inventory, and you wanted to have a certain level of presence in insider trading, accounting, financial fraud cases, nuts and bolts, supervision, and failure to supervise cases, and operational cases involving the financial services industry. And then you always had program areas where there was an emphasis, whether it was the S&L industry or the municipal securities industry, that largely emerged either from what was going on at the markets at the time or from a reasoned decision by the commission or the chairman about their view that there was an area of the marketplace that we ought to put resources into. In theory, you could take every lawyer, accountant, investigator in the division and put them in any one of those areas, and there was still more to do. The trick was to try to have a presence throughout most of the areas of the market and bring some real cases that sent a message, recognizing that you were not able to do all the cases and find everybody that was breaking the rules. It was an impossibility.
Yeah. One of the most notable insider trading cases that you all pursued during this period was the O'Hagan case.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was a quote from Richard Breeden during this period that this man should be left naked, homeless, and without wheels. So there seemed to have been a conscious attempt to sort of throw the book at him, right?
Yeah, and it's interesting because I remember, like it was yesterday, how and where that comment was made. It was actually made in a closed commission meeting and should never have seen the light of day, but like many other things, when something that interesting and colorful is uttered, it rarely stays within the room. And I mean, I remember the O'Hagan case quite well. It was one of my cases, and in fact, some of the lawyers that initially defended Mr. O'Hagan were in this law firm at the time. I think the chairman was stunned by what he had done and by the sheer, you know, nerve of it, and his reaction, as it was in many cases, he was not a shrinking wallflower, and he said what he thought, and that's what he believed. Believe me, he meant it.
Had the SEC also been looking for a chance to try to retest the misappropriation theory?
No. No. I mean, you're never looking. I mean, those decisions are made once you're faced with a set of circumstances and you think, all right, what are we going to do here? And the O'Hagan case was a case where, in the broadest sense, the sentiment was, if this isn't illegal, if we don't pursue it, shame on us. And if a court wants to say it's not, it's legal, then let a court do that. And then the Congress can deal with it. But we're not going to sit by and let this go. And it had a long, tortured history until it finally found its way to the Supreme Court. And we participated in the moot court preparation by Michael Dreeben, who argued the case in front of the Supreme Court, and he was absolutely spectacular. But there was a fairly unwavering sense that, you know, we'll go after this one for as long as it takes, and if somebody wants to say that what he did is perfectly appropriate, then let them say it, and then the Congress will have to deal with it.
Okay. One last thing on insider trading during this period. Was there any talk of moving towards what would become known as regulation fair disclosure at this time?
No. That emerged far later in the late 90s with Arthur Levitt when, we went through this enormous metamorphosis in the marketplace. If you were to trace from 1975 to 1985 to 1995 to 2000, the number of individual investors in the capital in the securities markets. And if you were to look at the impact that CNBC had on the popular interest in the stock market, you would see a shift in the pattern of what American families did with their wealth, which used to sit in passbook savings accounts, and basically move from that form of quote investment or savings into the equity markets, and driven in large part by the enormous returns that were generated in the 80s and into the 90s, and when the tech sector exploded in the 90s, the attraction for individuals in the stock market was just irresistible. So as all that went forward, we had the information revolution, we had real-time information on a 24-hour basis, and we had cell phones and the simply the availability of information in a technology-driven society to be worth what it was, even if you beat the market by an hour, all led to the sense that what was perceived as routine business in the securities industry, with the market professionals and the analysts getting a heads up and literally beating the market, was just wrong. And I have my own skepticism that FD was the right way to go about it. I don't know that I know there is a perfect way to go about it, but FD really emerged as a very populist-oriented solution to a problem of people cheating or being perceived to cheat by beating the market with the information.
So by the early 1990s, the SEC had begun to look into municipal bonds in a new way. There was new attention being paid to what were called pay-for-play scandals. What were these?
Right. The issue of pay-for-play was driven by, I think, the chairman at the time, Arthur Levitt's, sense that there was a very non-transparent underside of public finance, that you had state and local and municipal governments and pension plans and quasi-government managed retirement funds that had to turn to professionals for advice, for financing, for managing investments, for advising them on raising money for all sorts of public finance projects, and that what went on in that arena involved an enormous amount of inefficiency, in the sense that because it was public money, taxpayer dollars, and or public funds where there were tax-exempt status granted to the investments, there was a loose sense that nobody's really hurt if we all basically take care of ourselves. And whether that implicated the return that was granted to investors, the fees that were paid to the advisors, or the conflicts that existed between the advisors to the municipal enterprise and the people that were actually structuring the investment product and setting up the financing vehicle, there was an enormous amount of money that was basically being paid to advisors and professionals and investors and taxpayers, in fact, mm-hmm. getting cheated. And right. he was right.
Mm-hmm.
So and, you know, that was the genesis of the interest.
And then in 1993, the MSRB drafted a new rule, this rule G37, that
right.
Prohibited the bond dealers from accepting underwriting contracts from politicians within a certain amount of time.
Right.
It was later rewritten. But I was just wondering, how closely did the SEC work with the MSRB on this new rule, if at all?
As I sit here, I just don't recall. We at the time had an Office of Municipal Securities Regulation that the chairman had set up. It was headed by Paul Mako, and I don't recall what or the degree to which we had input with the MSRB on the drafting mm-hmm. of those rules.
Right. There were a number of big cases in the mid-1990s. Probably the biggest one was Orange County.
Right.
Its bankruptcy. As the SEC began to pursue that case, was there any pushback from politicians either on the state or local level or within the federal government?
I don't remember particular pushback other than skepticism and a sense that there was a sense of how dare you or who are you to be sticking your nose into the business of exempt securities. Nobody really challenged us and forced us to go to court. And I had always looked at the Orange County situation as one in which you couldn't win in terms of looking into it, because here we had a very conservative, politically, county where the county executives seem to be working miracles and generating enormous returns and reducing taxes and serving the people, and here was the government suddenly monkeying around and trying to look at it, when we find out that indeed there is a much bigger problem than, and the investments aren't secure, and then there were actually politicians criticizing us for not having done more in advance. And it was the kind of thing where I just think people, it's reflective of a broader issue in the American public, which is you want lower taxes, you want maximum efficiency, you want the police service to be great, the highways to be clean, the water to be clean, but you don't want the government fooling around in it, because that's costs money. And, you know, it was that sort of sense I had, particularly coming out of Orange County, based on some of the criticism that the agency got from some of the political leaders at the time.
That's probably not going to change anytime soon, right?
No.
Another big investigation by the mid-1990s was the one into the NASD. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, what drove the investigation was a sense that there was a level of, again, an absence of transparency and largely price inefficiency in the pricing of securities in that market. And a sense that because you had a bid and an ask and a certain spread that was built into the transactions, that we had investors who weren't getting the most efficient price for their dollar, and that while we're talking increments of pennies or pennies on a trade, you're also talking over time hundreds of millions and ultimately billions of dollars in inefficient profits that are going into Wall Street. And there was an enormous amount of resistance to the investigation, as well as to the conclusions. And the conclusions were driven largely as much by economic analysis and pure hardcore economic research as they were anyone coming in and saying on the record, oh yes, we do this, we do that. The area where it was clear there was some collusive behavior was in the penalties and the retaliation that were visited on firms who, in any given security, would narrow the spread to be more competitive or to capture more business.
Mm-hmm. And many of the records that you were using in this case came from these phone conversations they were having, right?
A fair number. Yeah. A fair number.
Was that unique to this case at the time?
At the time, it was pretty unique. There were cases where we had similar kinds of tapes, the old Bankers Trust case and the derivatives fraud that we had alleged against some traders at Bankers Trust and against the firm were based largely on tapes, but these were pretty good, and it was you had to go through thousands of hours of tapes to come up with a handful of conversations that were indeed critical, not because people weren't doing it most of the time. It's just that it was a convention where you didn't need to say a whole lot to get done what you need to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. No, they didn't have the same electronic discovery methods that they have today. So, was it mostly just young lawyers who were doing all this work? Or
lawyers, yeah.
Or did you have other staff, too, that were doing research?
We had anybody that could get time to listen, and it took hours and hours.
Right.
You know.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about working with Arthur Levitt on the commission.
Look, I worked for five chairmen, two of them as the director, and both of them were brilliant, and both of them couldn't be more different than night and day than Arthur Levitt and Richard Breeden. Arthur was probably the most politically astute chairman certainly in the modern era of the SEC. He had a capacity on difficult issues with people who ideologically were completely opposed to a perspective he had or an initiative he wanted, and he could bring them around in a way that was remarkable. And that's because he was pretty tough, but he was very patient, would spend a lot of time with people on the Hill. He and Phil Graham became quite good friends, even though philosophically I would suspect they were quite different in their views of the world. You know, he was somebody I got along with really well. He would drive me crazy some days, but he would always listen, and he was somebody I could always, wouldn't matter the time of day or the issue, I could just walk into his office. I never made appointments. I could always go in, just shut the door and say, "Can we get 10 minutes on something?" And he was a listener, mm-hmm. you know. Yeah. Really smart guy, very perceptive about the markets. Really credit him with the sense that the NASDAQ market needed to be reformed. And he had the vision with respect to what was wrong in the municipal securities market, just based on his intuitive sense of the way the industry works and the absence of a window on what goes on in that marketplace.
So in 1998, you decided to leave the SEC and go into the private sector. Was it difficult to make that transition?
It was hard to leave, only in the sense that you get used to doing something for as long as I'd been doing it. I'd never been in private practice, but I probably stayed even a few years beyond when it would have been advisable for me to leave, but I was having so much fun I didn't want to go. I decided I had to go do something different. Once I walked out the door, the transition was not hard at all. The only aspect of the transition from a job like that to private practice is you have to recognize that the day you walk out the door, whatever illusions you've held about how important you are, how smart you are, how much everybody wants to hear what you have to say, you better be prepared for the fact that you are just another lawyer and, you know, the press, the markets, people might remember your name, but you're of no grand significance in the scheme of things, because it's not you, it's really the agency and the title you had. And that's a far bigger sobering aspect of leaving a job like that than the transition to private practice. I did not find the transition difficult at all.
Yeah. You might be downplaying your role just a little bit in some of the events that followed. For instance, in the Interim and WorldCom cases, you ended up playing a pretty important role in those two events. Tell me a little bit about how you ended up as chairman of the Special Investigative Committee of Interim's Board of Directors.
Well, I wasn't. The chairman was Bill Powers. I ended up being the lead lawyer, and Wilmer represented the committee. But it came about in a way. We were not initially hired to represent the special committee. We were hired by Enron. I was at Dulles Airport on a plane to the West Coast for testimony the following day. It was a Sunday. My cell phone rang, or I had a message at work, and I returned the call, and it was a lawyer saying that the Enron was trying to reach me, wanted me to see if I was available to represent them, and I explained my schedule, said I'll be in the West Coast, and everybody said, "Look, we'll talk to you first thing tomorrow." I flew to San Francisco, got on the phone first thing the next morning, spoke to the general counsel, Jim Derrick, at the time, who was trying to arrange to have a private jet pick me up in San Francisco to bring me to Houston. That didn't work out. I came back to Washington, and on Wednesday evening, Joe Brenner, my partner at the time, and I flew to Houston, and we met with the general counsel, Jim Derrick, Ken Lay, Robert Causey, who is the chief financial officer, and then a host of other Enron executives. And they had hired us, they wanted to hire us to represent Enron. We cleared conflicts, and we sat for hours and got the sort of Enron perspective on the problem and the issue and what was involved. And the SEC was fairly aggressive. And within 48 hours, Joe and I had spent some time looking at all this. And Enron really wanted us to get on top of it and go in and explain it to the government and explain that there was no problem. And we consulted with a number of our partners here, and I went back to them and said, look, here's our advice. You should form a special committee, and you should empower the special committee to take a look at this, report to the board, and report to the government. If you do that, you can hold the government off and probably get this done and get it done far more quickly than if you go through the old-fashioned way. But if you sign up for that, it means you sign up for it. It means whatever the special committee finds will be reported to the government. So you got to understand that going in, and the special committee's got to be independent. We can't have management people in. So we went around and around. They agreed that made sense to them, given all the alternatives. They thought that was the wisest thing to do. We pushed to have the composition of the committee such that it was truly independent. By, if you went back and looked at the time period, this was September, October of 2001 or two, I'm not sure which, but the press coverage of Enron was escalating like, every day they were front page, new stories, new revelations, new concerns. We were successful in getting Bill Powers, who was recommended by, I think, Jim Derrick, to be the chairman of the special committee. He, at the time, was the dean of the University of Texas School of Law. And that's how the special committee came about. We really were hired to represent the company, and we told them if their objective was do it quickly, do it transparently, regain your credibility with the markets and the government, you got to do it independently, and the only way to do it independently is have a special committee. And if you buy this, you buy it whether it turns out being the golden egg or a rotten egg.
Right.
And that was the genesis of the whole matter.
Yeah. Did you participate in the investigation of the special committee too, or what?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. We were down there for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks, and we interviewed people, we looked at all the accounting records, we hired Deloitte and Touche and had some forensic accountants, including a quantitative guy who was able to take these special purpose entities apart and follow the structure all the way through. Mm-hmm. And the routine was pretty grueling. We would leave the Four Seasons at 7:30 every morning. We'd go the 8 or 10 blocks to Enron, we'd go in, we were there till 8, 9, 10, 11 at night, we'd go back to the hotel and then back again. It was an extraordinary few months, you know.
And then based part on your work with Enron, when WorldCom began having problems, they also contacted
right,
the firm, right?
Right.
And in this case, there also ended up being a special committee, right?
Yeah, and that was headed by Nick Katzenbach, and Richard Breeden was the was an ex officio member of the committee. I'm trying to remember who else was on the special committee at WorldCom.
As I understand it, the committee ended up finding some of the similar problems as was the case at Enron.
Right.
But in this case, it also assigned some responsibility to Arthur Andersen for its failure to audit appropriately.
On the WorldCom one?
On the WorldCom one,
yeah.
Were you surprised when Andersen ended up going under later?
Not really, given the press of the publicity and the blame that was being just shoveled around to everybody. There were some structural issues with the way that firm addressed complicated, difficult issues. They at the time, Andersen's approach to dealing with significant issues at the client level was to leave the decisions to the engagement partner. You could consult with the national office, but most other firms, once a decision, once an issue hits a certain point on the radar screen and is a big issue, the firm national office dictates the the answer or the position on tough accounting and GAAP issues. And Anderson was the reverse. And I think at core, in some respects, there are probably some other cultural issues, but that was a problem for the firm in deferring to management on some of these things.
Right. Was there any point when you were working on the Enron case or the WorldCom case when you felt, gosh, you know, there was some, maybe there was something we could have done at the SEC, maybe there was some regulation that could have been issued that would have prevented these cases from happening?
Never for a second.
No?
Never for a second.
So it was mostly just a human issue.
Enron and to some degree WorldCom were, in my view, arrogance and hubris and a belief that, certainly in Enron, that technical accounting structure, saying the right words, turning around three times and throwing salt over your right shoulder could somehow transform something without economic substance into something with economic substance. And it was and it was an arrogance that really overcame any skepticism or any common sense concern that, that a number of people could have and should have expressed. There was a culture of disdain for the government, disdain for competitors, and a belief that we are, the book that was written by M. Schwaller and Bethany McLean called Smartest Guys in the Room pretty much captured it. They thought they were the smartest guys in the room. You know?